I'm Mark Irons. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, a Green New Deal? The Vice President and Second Lady are among the leading U.S. officials spending the day in Greenland. We have a report and reaction. Terror in Thailand. Southeast Asia is rocked by a 7.7 magnitude quake. We have the latest. Pleading for the Fifth? A preview of the fifth season of The Chosen and how you can watch it. Plus, pilgrims and Thanksgiving. Why tens of thousands of the faithful are flocking to Assisi, Italy. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us tonight. Our top story, Vice President J.D. Vance and his wife visit an American military base in Greenland, landing in below zero temperatures. The trip comes after President Trump expressed his desire for U.S. control of the mineral-rich Danish territory. The president floated the idea during his first term of purchasing Greenland, even as Denmark insisted it wasn't for sale. Tonight, relations remain tense. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen?
Mark, also on that trip today, National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and Energy Secretary Chris Wright. The destination, Bidufik, on the northwest coast of Greenland.
In the Oval Office, President Donald Trump discusses Greenland, telling reporters,
We need Greenland, very importantly, for international security. We have to have Greenland. It's not a question of, do you think we can do without it? We can't.
And in Greenland, Vice President J.D. Vance lands at the U.S. Space Force outpost, 750 miles north of the Arctic Circle, the Defense Department's northernmost installation. He had lunch with the troops before delivering remarks.
We need to ensure that America is leading in the Arctic, because we know that if America doesn't, other nations will fill the gap where we fall behind.
Locked in by ice for 9 months of the year, the base supports missile defense and space surveillance operations for the U.S. and NATO.
If a missile was fired from an enemy country or an enemy submarine into the United States, it is the people here before us who would give notice.
But the trip today to the semi-autonomous Danish territory scaled back after an uproar among Greenlanders and Danes who were irked that the original itinerary was planned without consulting them.
The negative rhetoric from the U.S. has made a lot of fear here in Greenland to work towards independence. But we are fully aware that we can't be fully independent. That's utopia. We need cooperation.
Four of the five parties elected to Greenland's parliament earlier this month agreed to form a coalition government. They banded together in the face of President Trump's designs on the territory.
Our right to external self-determination, our right to sovereignty of Greenland is non-negotiable, but we will always be willing to work with the United States in regards to defense and security, as we have always done.
Now, Vance's one-day visit removed the risk of potentially violating diplomatic custom by sending a delegation to another country without an official invitation. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
For more on this, we turn to Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this. In his remarks today, the Vice President said the people of Greenland eventually will choose to become part of the U.S., that despite a poll in late January that said 85% of the population is against such a move. Help us unpack this. It sounds like President Trump doesn't have the support there in Greenland.
Well, this is like a lot of the big issues that the new Trump administration has taken on very early in their tenure, where they lay out a vision somewhat down the road, and then there's a little bit of a shock reaction, and people step back and start working step by step. And so Vice President Vance made very clear today that the first step is going to be Greenland exercising self-determination and basically declaring independence from Denmark. After they have done that, they would be within their sovereign rights to negotiate a new compact with the United States, whether that's some kind of federation of becoming a territory of the United States or just having a new strategic relationship with the United States. There would be just a different path forward for the future. But this matters for the geostrategic reasons the vice president mentioned about global missile defense and looking at access to resources, but also because there's clear evidence that China has been encroaching upon the Arctic and it has never been an Arctic power.
Let's talk a bit more about that. Why does the Trump administration think Greenland could be such a crucial part of America's national security?
Well, in some ways, it's like the East Coast pairing with Alaska, which also was not taken by conquest, but by agreement. And it's the location that matters in terms of access to space and for continental, intercontinental missile defense kinds of purposes. But there's also resource rich, as is Alaska on the western coast. And so if we're going to reduce our dependencies on China for access to rare earths and other kinds of important resources, we're going to preserve the strategic access to the Arctic only by those who are truly Arctic powers, then this piece of real estate is very, very important for the United States, but also for the partners in the free world.
So what's next? There was a lot of pushback in Denmark today. What happens next, Steve?
I think publics generally are shocked when big change is put before them, but I think they've heard plenty that the United States is prepared to have a very generous relationship with Greenland. And you could hear in the segment that you led with that there's general goodwill towards the United States and a recognition that such a small population in a very strategic location is going to need to have good relations with an outside power, especially one like the United States. So I think we'll let the pop and sizzle of this visit cool a bit before we assess where their reaction is going to go. But the Trump administration, make no mistake, has planted the flag that they're serious about this.
Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, thank you.
Thank you.
In the midst of a heated trade war, President Trump and the new Canadian Prime Minister held their first phone call.
I'm not referring to Canada, but many countries have taken advantage of us, the likes of which nobody even thought was possible for many, many decades, for decades. And, you know, that has to stop. We're going to end up with a very good relationship with Canada and a lot of the other countries. Some we probably won't. It won't be so pleasant.
In the 2 weeks since Mark Carney became Canada's prime minister, he's been very critical of the U.S. president, saying the tariffs and comments about Canada becoming the 51st state have broken the relationship between the two neighbors. And more than 100 are dead following a devastating earthquake in Myanmar and Thailand. As you can see from the footage, the 7.7 magnitude quake caused extensive damage, toppling buildings, destroying bridges and dams. Aftershocks followed the quake, with one as strong as 6.4. Officials say it could be weeks before the full extent of the destruction is known. Pope Francis also sent his condolences to church and civil authorities, saying he was deeply saddened by the loss of life and widespread devastation. And joining us now to talk more about this is Douglas Weens, professor of Earth, Environmental, and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. Douglas, thank you so much for joining us. We've seen the images, but tell us just how bad is this?
This is a really devastating earthquake. It's magnitude 7.7, but it's under an area that's very populated. And it's a relatively shallow earthquake, and all of those are kind of bad factors in terms of the kind of damage that we're going to expect. The U.S. Geological Survey has a little tool where they estimate the casualties and monetary damages, and it's possible that we'll see 10,000 or more fatalities from this event when everything's counted.
That's devastating. And Myanmar is one of the world's poorest countries. What kind of infrastructure is available to help out a struggling nation after such a damaging quake?
I'm not particular. I don't know that much about Myanmar's infrastructure itself, but most countries that are poorer don't have enough infrastructure themselves to try to recover from an event like this. So it's up to kind of the international community and some of the other countries in the area to try to help them recover from this kind of disaster.
Well, what was it about this earthquake that made it so unique? 7.7 is incredibly strong. What determines how severe any given earthquake will be?
Well, this earthquake was on a major fault. There's a major fault going through Myanmar, and it's because the Indian subcontinent is moving north, colliding into China at the Himalayan mountains. And then the motion happens along this fault. And so there have been a lot of earthquakes in this country before. It has a history of earthquakes. And this fault is, it's essentially like the San Andreas fault. It's the same kind of fault. And so you can have the same kind of damage on this fault as we had in like the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. And I think another factor in terms of the damage is perhaps the condition of some of the buildings. I don't know for sure what the criteria are for building in this country, but we know, like from in the Turkey earthquake, the condition of the building was a big problem.
We know officials say the full extent of the damage won't be known for at least a few weeks. As you say, it's hard to say what will come of this, but what do you think is next for the people in Myanmar?
Well, I think they just have to survive the next few days. There'll probably be more aftershocks, and so there'll be a possibility of damage from aftershocks, although that will be decreasing in the coming days. And then there's just issues like where do you get drinking water from that's safe? Where do you get shelter if your building has collapsed? And how do the injured people, get medical care when there's so many, when it's sort of overwhelming the resources of that country?
All right. Douglas Weens, thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
In his first official trip to Asia, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth met with leaders of the Philippines today to assure them of America's commitment to the Pacific region.
We are resolved at this time, at this moment, to work with our partners to reestablish the warrior ethos, to rebuild our military, and reestablish deterrence.
Mr. Hegseth's trip comes at a time of concern among Asian nations. They are worried that the America First mindset of the Trump administration will leave them vulnerable to China. Hegseth reassured people in the Philippines of America's commitment to them. He then boarded a flight to Japan to reassure Japanese leadership as well. And in the Middle East, Israel has launched another attack, this one in the Lebanese capital of Beirut. It's the first attack on Beirut since a ceasefire ended the Israel-Hezbollah war in November. Israel says it struck a Hezbollah drone storage facility in the city after rockets were fired into northern Israel. Hezbollah denies firing the rockets and accuses Israel of looking for a reason to strike Lebanon. And a battle is brewing on Capitol Hill over a family issue. Florida Congresswoman Ana Paulina Luna and House GOP leaders are at odds over looming floor action to allow proxy voting for members of Congress who are new parents. Both sides are digging in their heels with a clash potentially coming as soon as next week. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales has the latest. Eric?
Good evening. Before Florida Congresswoman Ana Paulina Luna, a new mother, headed back to her home state, she doubled down on her effort to pass proxy voting for new parents who are members of Congress. She says she has no intentions of backing down, despite leadership offering her prime committee spots and other incentives. She says she cannot be bought.
I don't play to lose. You are seeing a majority of the conference, Republicans and Democrats, supporting this. And to be told that somehow allowing members and family to, or allowing new members of Congress that have families, men and women, to vote is somehow going to destroy the democracy.
Congresswoman Luna, who gave birth while in Congress in 2023, teamed up with another new mom, Democratic Representative Brittany Pederson. Over half of the House has signed on, enough to force a vote, which could happen as soon as next week.
We are having more women, younger women, women of childbearing age, years, who are coming to Capitol Hill. So if they get pregnant, which is an awesome thing, and they have a child, which is an awesome thing, let's have a little bit of grace.
It's a reasonable accommodation to women in that situation. And there might be other cases where someone is, disabled or incapacitated to a certain degree, where they might be hospitalized.
But Speaker Mike Johnson argues it creates a slippery slope.
I believe it's unconstitutional. I believe it violates more than two centuries of tradition in the institution. And I think that it opens a Pandora's box where ultimately maybe no one is here and we're all voting remotely by AI or something. I don't know.
Luna claims she and others are now being threatened by Republican leadership.
Just elaborate how they're threatening.
Legislation, not helping with fundraising in districts, all of it.
By the way, proxy voting was used by both parties when it was implemented under the Democratic leadership during the COVID-19 pandemic. But then former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy dropped it when Republicans took control. But the issue is not likely to go away. Arizona Congresswoman Kat Kamak recently announced she's expecting a child due this summer. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
The Trump administration is asking the Supreme Court for permission to resume deportations of Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador under the 18th Century Alien Enemies Act. The appeal comes after a lower court rejected the administration's plea, leaving in place an order temporarily prohibiting the deportations. The case is the latest in a showdown between the White House and federal courts. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, a labor fight in the Sunshine State. Lawmakers in Florida are pushing to end restrictions on child labor. We have the details of the controversial proposal. Plus, hundreds of thousands of Catholics are pouring into a small medieval town in preparation for a big event next month. Prayer and peaceful protest. That is the plan for the faithful in response to a so-called Black Mass held earlier today outside the Capitol building in Topeka, Kansas. On social media, Catholic Vote posted a photo of a packed church just across the street from the Capitol building. Archbishop Joseph Naumann celebrated Mass and led a holy hour in reparation for the satanic service. The church leader called the Black Mass an affront to all Christians, but added we should not, quote, succumb to anger and violence, as that would be cooperating with the devil. In Florida, a bill in the state legislature is making national headlines for seeking to relax child labor laws. The proposal narrowly passed a state Senate panel on Tuesday. It would eliminate regulations that keep 16 and 17-year-olds from working jobs before 6 a.m. or after 11 p.m. on school days. It would also allow teens to work 8 hours on school days and work more than 30 hours a week. It would end the requirement that teens get a meal break of at least 30 minutes when they work 8 hours. It would also get rid of restrictions for 14 and 15-year-olds who are homeschooled. And joining us now in this discussion, Harley Shaken, professor at UC Berkeley, who specializes in labor and global economy. Harley, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
First, this bill is in response to a shortage of labor, due in part to a crackdown on immigration. Could we start seeing more bills like this across the country?
I hope not, but it's certainly very possible. This bill takes us back more than a century to roughly 1910, when children were working in mills, in mines, in all kinds of work. To roll back the protections we've built up over the years against child labor seems like a rather extraordinary and very disturbing step.
And in modern times, have we seen this kind of relaxation of child labor laws anywhere else? If so, what were the results?
I'm not aware of any relaxation remotely like this, let alone in an economy such as ours. It's not just that the children really will be working hard with little protection immediately, but the damage could last the rest of their lives. We split the country into two classes. Those where the parents are able to send their children to public schools, and those where children are working. And even though they may be attending classes, if you're working all night, what's your attention span going to be? So it's pretty dismal and really, really hard to understand.
Well, opponents of the bill say it will negatively affect school performance. However, supporters say it will give teens good experience. What has history shown?
Oh, that it will be very bad. We can look most recently at what happened to school test scores during COVID. Just the disruption of going to class led to market declines that we are still recovering from, and in some cases may never recover from. So it's not just, well, it'll be tough for a bit. It really will have lasting impact and mark the poorest and most vulnerable children for a lifetime where they won't be able to catch up.
Harley, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives here.
Thank you.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, it's one of the biggest series in the world. Now it hits the big screen. Season 5 of The Chosen is out today, but only in movie theaters. We have a preview. Plus, an ancient city is seeing an influx in tourists, and it's all because of a big event for the Catholic Church next month. We'll explain. Welcome back. Today is the 100th anniversary of the ordination of one of the most influential figures in recent church history. On this date in 1925 in Zaragoza, Spain, Saint Jose Maria Escriva was ordained to the priesthood. He later founded Opus Dei and is considered the patron saint of people with diabetes. Events to honor Saint Jose Maria will take place in Spain and Rome. Opus Dei is also providing on its website a free prayer card available in 13 languages. Hundreds of thousands of pilgrims are pouring into a medieval town in Italy, all in anticipation of a major event next month. The crowds are flocking to the tomb of Blessed Carlo Acutis ahead of his canonization April 27th in Rome. Acutis died in 2006 at the age of 15. His life and death show how a regular teen of today's world can achieve holiness and inspire other young people. One church leader estimates that since last year, around 1 million people have visited the tomb of Carlo Acutis. The sixth major Jubilee event kicked off today in Rome. It involves the Missionaries of Mercy, a global ministry whose numbers are now more than 1,200 strong. One priest says the group has never been more visible.
The Missionaries of Mercy, or Apostolic Missionaries, have always been a part of the church's story, but never have we had over 1,000 at the same time. All through history, we have had one or two apostolic missionaries like Louis Maria de Montfort. He was a missionary, not Missionary of Mercy, but an apostolic missionary instituted by the Pope during his lifetime. But this is the first time we're so many with one singular focus, bringing the mercy and joy of Christ to people around. Be that visible sign of God's presence, of God's mercy and love. Mercy and hope shares a very important link, and I believe that's part of the reason the celebration of the Jubilee of Priests, instituted as Missionaries of Mercy, is also included in the Jubilee of Hope, so that we can go out there and remind everyone of this connection, that while we wait, we must embrace God's mercy.
While it is one of the oldest stories ever told, learning about the life of Jesus is experiencing a new appeal thanks to the TV series The Chosen. Season 5 arrived today, but if you want to see it, you'll have to head to the theaters. Francesca Fenton reports.
I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, even if he dies, will live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die.
The Chosen is back. The series that follows the life and passion of Jesus Christ has attracted religious and secular audiences alike. Since the fifth and latest season is premiering in the theaters, cast members have hit the road to promote its release.
I think the fans will really get a kick out of the table flipping scenes and the temple cleansing scenes. It's a side of Jesus that we haven't depicted before. And in a way that I don't think has ever really been captured on film and in television before. And to the extent that we actually cover it scripturally and otherwise.
In February, the show inked an exclusive streaming deal with Amazon Prime Video. But the agreement delays the debut of the latest season on the streamer until June. Yet, creators and cast are encouraging fans to catch it on the big screen.
From moment one, you are in it, and it's emotional and it's intense. And this whole season is a powder keg, and we like light the match right away on right off the bat. And you're also going to see a few big scriptural moments just in part one of season 5. So this is going to be an exciting night.
In season 5, we see Tamar settle into her space. We see her kind of fully realized. I believe that she spent so much of her journey trying to be important in some way, and I feel like she has finally released that.
And that while viewers know how the story ends, they will still be surprised.
The Last Supper. I mean, come on. Like, we had Annie Leibovitz. It's going to be good. It's going to be better than they expected. Not only are we going to give them what they expected, but they're not going to see it coming. How can you do that? They know everything, and they will still not see it coming.
Reporting from Dallas, Texas, Francesca Fenton for EWTN News Nightly.
We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Mark Irons. Good night, and God bless.